You all back to a very first meeting of the Subcommittee on Child Care Access and Affordability. Before we begin, I've got some exciting news. We have some new staff. So we have Mary McNamara to my left. She is the committee legislative assistant, and so my legislative assistant. She's super awesome. And then we have Allison Roble. She is the house researcher. And where's Allison? Yep, right down there. She's awesome as well. And then we have Mark Lalaberty. I am so glad that he put his pronunciation down on the sheet so that I didn't, you know, mess that up. He is our committee administrator, and he is so organized. I am so excited to have him on our team. And then we have Dave Sullivan returning as our DFL researcher, so we did not scare him off from last session. So welcome back, Dave. Just a reminder, members, that the subcommittee falls under the jurisdiction of Health and Human Services Reform Committee, and we will have bills referred to us from that committee only. The subcommittee can unofficially amend the referred bills before being considered by the full Health and Human Services Reform Committee. Currently, we do not have any bills before this committee that have been referred. Reminder that last session, Chair Schumacher had asked that the subcommittee work be completed 3 weeks before deadline. We are anticipating with this short session. Did we get our deadlines? We got our deadlines, right?
Yeah, we did just yesterday.
Okay. Well, as of now, we're anticipating our work needs to be done by March 20th, so not a whole heck of a lot of time. The date is subject to change, though, at the will of the chair. Schumacher, that is. Included in the folder are the subcommittee rules. I would like to point out that the committee has an amendment deadline 3 p.m. the prior day of our committee meetings. Amendments that will need to be provided to the committee administrator via electronic format so that they can be posted on the interwebs. These committee sub-rules are the same rules that are in place for the Subcommittee on Aging and Long-Term Care. Are there any questions on the rules from our full committee here? Okay. Well, all these documents have been posted on the committee webpage as well. And as you know, members, the subcommittee will be holding an informational meeting today. We will hear several presentations lasting approximately 10 to 12 minutes. At the end of the presentations, we will use our remaining time for discussions and questions, so I ask that you write everything down so you don't forget, so at the end you can ask those important questions. Do we have any questions right now before we begin? No? Okay. Well, I thought it would be helpful to start by putting a human face on the work that we will be doing this session. As such, we have asked a few providers to come in today and present an overview of the challenges they are facing as childcare providers. So we are going to start with Julie Seidel. Julie, would you come on down to the stand? Julie is from Anoka County. She owns Cozy Kids Licensed Home Daycare, and she is also the public policy director for Minnesota Association Child Care Providers. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair members. Excuse me. I'm here today to ask for your support in addressing the growing child care crisis in Minnesota, which undoubtedly has contributed to the growing worker shortage, as parents cannot work if they are unable to find care for their children. In the fall of 2016, the Task Force on Child Care Affordability and Accessibility held hearings, and child care providers from all parts of the state came to share what we have been experiencing in recent years. I'd like to touch on some of those points shared by providers at the hearing and offer some potential solutions. Oversight. The task force heard from many providers, including myself, who noticed a drastic shift in the methods of oversight in the last 7 years by the Department of Human Services and some county licensors. Increasingly punitive in nature, with more violations, harsher interpretations of rules and law, and far less support for child care providers trying to navigate the ever-changing expectations. You would be hard-pressed to find many child care providers who don't lose sleep over inspections and who feel confident that they are doing everything that is expected of them. A close look at the decline in providers over the last 12 years supports the testimony of providers. According to annual reports released by Child Care Aware, from 2006 to 2011, Minnesota lost 789 child care providers. From 2011 to date, we have lost 3,088 providers. We continue to lose, on average, 1.5 child care providers each day. To address this, MACCP recommends an overhaul of current oversight practices with the new protections for providers. This includes a requirement for fair and detailed correction actions free from embellishment that allows providers to include a response to the accusation in the violation. Only accurate and fair actions should be posted on the public website. We recommend a fair appeals process for all corrective and negative actions to an administrative law judge so the Department of Human Services no longer gets to police their own actions. With this, we recommend an expedited appeals process so child care providers are not closed down for months upon months over accusations that may not even be true. We strongly support a requirement for DHS to accept the administrative law judge ruling as final. The current system allows DHS to drag an appeals process on for months, and even when the ALJ rules in favor of the provider, DHS gets to choose whether or not they accept the judge's ruling. Regulations. The state of Minnesota began licensing and regulating child care as a measure to protect children. Licensure was supposed to set a minimum baseline of health and safety standards. Today, it has far surpassed that, and child care providers are now heavily regulated by many rules and laws, some of which do nothing to protect children. Child care providers can now be issued violations for not washing an infant's bottle immediately after use or for not recording the time of day they conducted their monthly fire drills. Minnesota needs to go back to basics and reexamine all rules and laws governing child care and eliminate unnecessary regulations and ensure that any remaining regulations are clear and fair. However, while we understand current calls to reopen Rule 2, MACCP strongly opposes doing so right now under the existing rule structure. Currently, DHS has the authority to rewrite Rule 2, and the process lacks transparency. It's no secret that child care providers, including myself, have been frustrated with the lack of transparency and meaningful communication between DHS and providers. It's hard to get answers to even basic questions, and too often our concerns are disregarded. We cannot and will not support the Department of Human Services under the current leadership, the same leadership we've lost more than 3,000 child care providers under, to rewrite the rule, as we believe the result would be devastating for family child care. MACCP supports transferring rulemaking authority from DHS to the legislature and would support a task force or committee that includes family child care providers to propose changes to the rule. We support an open legislative process for all rule changes. Paperwork. In 2016, the task force heard about redundant and unnecessary paperwork requirements. Instead of reducing and streamlining paperwork, we actually ended the session with more paperwork. MACCP recommends eliminating all unnecessary paperwork, and we have written a bill this year to eliminate the annual insurance notification to parents, and we hope you will consider signing on to supporting this bill. Training. In 2013, the required training hours were doubled for licensed family child care providers, and new required classes were introduced. Having to take the same classes over and over again is unnecessary and uninspiring. MACCP recommends relaxing training requirements so child care providers have more flexibility to take classes that meet their own professional development needs. We also recommend relaxing requirements for trainers and new classes and develop the class registry tool so it's easier to bring in educators in from outstate. MACCP also supports allowing more flexibility for providers who face hardships so a child care provider undergoing chemotherapy does not lose her license for not getting all 16 hours in before her relicense date. Insurance. State law allows insurance companies to deny coverage to child care providers who care for more than 5 children. This makes it difficult and costly to obtain homeowners insurance for child care providers. MACCP has written a bill to prohibit these underwriting practices when the provider has a business liability policy. We will hope you'll consider supporting that. Fingerprint background studies. At the tail end of the legislative session last year, DHS was able to include a number of harmful provisions that never received a hearing or an opportunity for public feedback. One of these provisions was misclassifying our children as child care staff persons in an attempt to require invasive fingerprint background studies on them. New federal law required all child care staff persons undergo these studies, but children were not included in the federal requirement. There is a Senate file 2683 to repeal the fingerprinting of our minor children. Without this repeal, the loss of family child care homes will be immense. The current background studies our children go through are so thorough that they can be disqualified without having ever been convicted or even charged with a crime. Fingerprinting and photographing them like criminals is an unnecessary violation of their rights and privacy. In addition to the concerns regarding fingerprint of minor children, DHS still has not provided full and honest disclosure about what these new fingerprint background studies will entail. They have traveled the state telling child care providers the FBI will not keep their fingerprints or photographs, yet state law clearly says they will. In addition, the FBI's privacy statement for the NGI database clearly says prints are kept until we are 110 or have been dead for 7 years. DHS has not yet confirmed to providers if they are enrolling us in the FBI's Rat Pack program, yet the report to legislature last year indicates this is what they intend to do. Permanent entry into the FBI's database, the same database as convicted criminals, where our prints will be searched daily for the rest of our lives, is a very serious proposal. It should not take 9 months in legal aid to get the disclosure we deserve. MACCP supports language this year that will require DHS to give full and honest disclosure about who will have access to our biometric and personal data, how long they will keep it, and how it will be used. We've written language that will require the agency submitting our prints and personal data to the FBI to request it be removed once we no longer require to submit to background studies. We hope you will support this language also. These are only some of the recommendations MACCP made to the task force in 2016. I have emailed a complete list of recommendations to the committee for your consideration. Thank you for hearing my testimony today.
Thank you, Julie. Right, next up we have Elizabeth Vangert. She's from Mankato and she owns, here we go. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Elizabeth Bangert. I am the owner and director, of Here We Grow Early Childhood Center in Mankato, and I also serve as a consultant. I had this 3-page letter that I was going to read, and I'm not going to read it. And I apologize if I start crying. The past 3 weeks, since something big happened in our country, I've watched students walk to the Capitol and lay down and demand gun reform. I've watched one person, hashtag me too, and a whole nation started talking. But over the last 7 days, after requesting to testify here, I was told by an individual only to speak to the broad issues and not get down to the specifics. And I don't understand how we're supposed to address the crisis if we don't talk about what's actually happening. So I'm asking for your permission to proceed with sharing things without mentioning names, things that are sitting in the audience impacting people today who rode with me from Mankato. And if not, I understand your decision, but I have to figure out a way to share our story. May I proceed?
Go ahead.
On October 11, 2017, I received a phone call that rocked my world. Here We Grow is being investigated for maltreatment because a child fell off a slide 2 feet. I didn't understand what my rights were. I cannot afford an attorney. I have 50% of my revenue that is delayed every month because of parent aware scholarships and CCAP payments. I am one person. I live in a 1,000-square-foot house. My husband and I work 60-plus hours a week. I could not afford an attorney. I had to go to Senator Frentz to help me understand what my rights were. DHS then produced a document that was forwarded only to them. It was not put on the public website afterward, explaining what my rights were as a provider. I then closed because I knew the impact it would have on my teachers, and DHS did not show up that day. They showed up a week later. I had parents who were upset because their children went home and saw their teachers crying and heard them throwing up in the bathroom. I have a teacher here today who was crying because she asked me afterwards because of what was said on that sheet and told her at the end of the interview, you can lose your right to work with children if she would lose her teaching license. This is real. These are our lives. And because of that, my colleague and I started digging into citations. We have made it through 300 out of 1,809 child care centers. line by line, entering them into an Excel database. 41 violations for plungers in the bathroom. Plungers in the bathroom. 40 violations for adult scissors on a countertop. A violation for prickly grass. And my favorite, rabbit poop in the yard. And a stick. These are the things that we live with. This is public data that has been there for years, and DHS is doing nothing. And furthermore, I have an individual here who is in the newspaper for not having enough Play-Doh. In a letter dated August 17th, 2017, from Emily Piper, which was forwarded to me by a source I will keep anonymous, she cites two main points on the second page. Cite point number one was that the marble shaming jar was actually a legitimate citation. Point number two was the Play-Doh citation would be revoked. Here we are, still 6 months later, and as of Sunday, that was not changed. So I emailed the person back who told me about this letter. And then magically the next day, the Department of Human Services rescinded it. What happened? Why does it take me playing the guard of our lives? I don't want to be chosen. I've begged God. I'm a Christian. I've begged God. I don't want to be chosen for this. I don't want to sit here. I don't want to talk about these things because I know that I will be targeted. This is very real. My house is on the line. There is a person sitting here who has a conditional license right now who's being played games with their licensor. But we uncovered an individual who had 33 violations and the next time 17 repeat violations, and they do not have a conditional license. What are the criteria for conditional licenses? Furthermore, for maltreatment, I don't even know what the criteria are for that. There was a child who was taped to a chair with painter's tape, not documented as maltreatment, but a door accidentally closed, pinched an infant's finger, and that person can no longer work with children. You tell me how that is fair. Who would want this job for an average wage of $9.06 an hour when 46% of child care workers in this country live in poverty and use child care assistance or some form of state assistance? Who would want this job? And then you don't even have a fighting chance. You go to an ALJ, and they make a decision, and the DHS turns it over. I have people flooding my inbox in my email with anonymous stories, begging me to keep their stories quiet because they don't want repercussions of things that have happened in their county. A New Ulm provider drove from New Ulm to Mankato to tell me about what happened in her home, how DHS came to investigate her when her child was in the hospital up at Children's. 3 days later, her child died. But she was told, if you don't come down and we investigate this now, your daycare closes. What a terrible decision. Who is watching these people? Where is the report that is due to the legislature that is required by statute? Who is monitoring them? They have too much power. I love my job and I love what I do, but I don't want to do this anymore. No one would want to do this. I don't understand. I would love the opportunity to share more of our data. We are working on compiling it because it tells a story. And it tells a story 300 licenses in out of 1,809 that is terrifying. And it needs to be told for change to happen. Theodore Roosevelt gave a speech in the arena called The Arena. And he says, it is not the person who points out. It is not the strong man who points out what the other doers have done wrong. But what it goes on to say is, it's the people in the arena with blood and sweat and tears, and no one's listening to us. I can't believe that in less than 24 hours, I magically had the power to get someone's things rescinded because I was going to out the Department of Human Services. What are you hiding?
Thank you. Members, we have our work cut out for us. Next up we have, Kathy Smith. Kathy, is from Maplewood and White Bear Lake and used to own?
Yes.
The Liberty Classical Academies.
Yes.
And Maplewood and White Bear Lake.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Committee, thank you for letting me be here this morning. I have to tell you that after Julie and Elizabeth, mine's not going to be quite as interesting. Because they are amazing, and they're in the fight, and I no longer am. I'm an ex-provider, and this is my story. In 2010, a private school had a wonderful dilemma. Out of our 20 teachers, three of them decided to have children, two children within 2 years. So now we had six little ones to think about. Now, most cases, for a teacher, this might cause them to be home. But our teachers were dedicated to the school, and they were dedicated to their work. And they wanted to be near their children. So the school decided that we would find a way to provide childcare for them. So we worked with Ramsey County to have an employee-based family childcare in our two locations in White Bear Lake in Maplewood. Now we are the Liberty Lions, and so we called it the Cubbies program for the little kids. This program went on very strongly, and those six little ones grew up and others replaced them. But in 2014, all of that ended. Because of the new regulations that were put in place, we had to stop. We stopped because the changes made it no longer an option for us. So we let our licenses lapse and we closed the program. Subsequently, our teachers were without assistance and some of them left. I know you must be familiar with the Minnesota Child Mortality Review Panel's report of 2012. I believe it was the catalyst for a lot of the changes that were made in regulations. If you've read the report, you'll see that the infant deaths were clumped together. Any form of death was clumped together to a total of 83 in 10 years. They didn't separate out the ones that had serious illnesses. They didn't separate out the ones that died of SIDS where the child care provider was not at fault. They just threw them all together. And because of that, the small number that were not following regulations forced change on the whole state. So those maybe four caregivers on average a year affected 1,590 caregivers who were following. In 2013, in January, I spoke at the Health and Human Services Committee hearing, and I pleaded with them to not force this kind of a change on the entire state. My plea was unanswered, and 5 years later, we have a loss of about 29% of our child care, our family child care programs. I do not want to downplay the precious infants that lost their life due to the negligence of a caregiver, but it is much smaller than what was presented in the report and subsequently in the newspaper and the media. I believe it was all used as a purpose to close family child care programs, and it worked. Now the new regulations make it almost impossible to make having a family child care license feasible and productive. I believe that the fact sheet from the Inspector General dated updated March 2017 stated it best when they said that closures peaked in 2013, and that was heard from providers that both the media focus on the infant deaths in family child care and the resulting new regulations contributed to the factors of the providers leaving the field. And some of these providers had provided care for over 15 years. Now, to someone not in the family child care business, it might be hard to understand how these new regulations would annihilate your business. So I'll illustrate it with some simple math. I am a teacher, and so if you would join with me in this little example, that would be great. Let's say you have six kids, and they pay an average of $100 a week. So how much do you have a month? Six a week, so six times four, 2,400. Excellent. All right. And from that 2,400, you need to set aside a third for taxes, so you have 1,600. Okay, so we got 1,600. Okay, sorry, it's early in the morning. I'm throwing things at you. Okay, from that, so now you're down to 1,600. Let's say you've got your liability insurance for about 150. You're going to have snacks for the kids. You've got to have breakfast and lunch and morning snack and afternoon snack. $75 a week. I'm being very tight on the budget. Let's say it's $300 a month. So now you subtract that from the 1,600, and you're down to 1,150. Okay, good. So we got the 150 minus the 300 from the 1,650. So we're at 1,150. And then any caregiver worth their ounce in gold is going to be buying miscellaneous supplies, right? Art supplies, those types of things. Say an average of 150 a month. Again, I'm going really small. So we're down to about $1,000. Take that $1,000, split it into 4 weeks, 250, split it 5 days, $50 a day. And child care works an average of 9 hours a day. So we're talking about $5.50 an hour that child care provider is making. So I think you can see why we've dropped. Now, that was in 2010, when our caregivers were only required about 8 hours of training a year, and our substitutes only needed 2 to 6 hours, depending on how their CPR training was. In total, that might cost a caregiver about $100. Fast forward to 2018. Now, I haven't been a care provider, so I just did some research, and my numbers might be a little off, but I believe that Julie shared some of them. But it went from 8 hours to 23 to 27 hours. But not just for you, also for your substitute. So where you used to only have to have 2 hours or so for your substitute, now you have 27. And for you to have to go to those courses, you need to hire somebody to watch your kids. So you've got that expense on top of the other expense. So you went from it being about $100 to $200 a year to being from $800 to $1,000 a year just to be able to meet those requirements. And that's just the training. We're not talking about the upkeep of your home or the advancement of materials for your kids. I think you can see why we're down 29% in family child care programs. But the best part is you can change this. This team can change this. You can make it possible for caregivers to rise up and give excellent care to the children of Minnesota. This may seem harsh, but it's because of this governing body that we've lost them, and it's because of this governing body that we can rejuvenate the child care programs in Minnesota. I know you'll make a difference. You'll find a way so more caregivers can cherish our new little Minnesotans. With your dedicated hearts and having a team that brings the strength of Alexandria, Burnsville, Plymouth, Shakopee, Blaine, Long Prairie, Rochester, and Hibbing, I know you'll find the answer. Our state needs you to help us to provide for the approximate 86,000 children that the Inspector General calculated who still need care. The caregivers are out there. The children are waiting, and the ball is in your court. Thank you.
Kathy, I think we may be all inspired here after that. Have you thought about being a motivational speaker?
I'm a teacher.
Thank you. And thank you all to those who put a human element on that testimony. It was very shocking, to say the least. And so, DHS, I think you might be on notice here. Next up, we have a Think Small report. All right. So during the interim, the committee staff and I became aware of some important investigational work being conducted by Think Small. They've conducted interviews across the state with providers who have left the business. Now that we've heard from the human side of the story, I think it's important that we take a look at the analytics. So Think Small is here today to point out their results. So thank you, Cisa. It's been a little.
Cisa Keller.
Yes, Cisa Keller. Next time, put that as a pronunciation for me. So welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. So again, my name is Cisa Keller. I'm the Senior Vice President of Early Childhood Quality Development at Think Small. Think Small is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the quality care and education for children in their crucial early years. We do this through preparing providers, strengthening families, and catalyzing change. I was invited here today to talk about a survey that Think Small completed regarding family child care business closure. This survey was completed as part of a collaborative effort between Think Small and Generation Next to significantly increase the early learning program quality and outcomes for children in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. To achieve this effort, we focused on increasing the number of high-quality early learning options for families with a particular emphasis on licensed family child care. We call this work Pathways to Quality, and I've actually included in your packet kind of a one-pager describing the Pathways to Quality work. But our Pathways to Quality activities focused on five areas: quality supports, social and emotional supports, family supports, business supports, and finally kindergarten transition. Our theory of change was that a combination of these supports would result in increased quality early learning options that meet the needs of families. The survey in question was completed as part of our business support activities. As you've heard, Minnesota is losing family child care providers across the state, resulting in what is commonly being known as child care deserts. I want to point out that the child care deserts are present both in the urban core as well as in rural Minnesota. This is concerning, but especially so when we consider that family child care providers are a generally more affordable option than center-based care and are more reflective of a family's race, culture, and language. In an effort to address the decline in family child care, Think Small and Generation Next felt it was necessary to understand why providers were closing their doors, thus the survey, which you do have a handout summarizing all that, and I'm just going to highlight a few of the things. And just a note for those of you in the audience, if you don't have a handout, this is all located on our website, so you can look at it later on. But basically, we did the survey of about 1,700 family child care providers that closed their doors between January of 2015 and January of 2017. At a high level, the results showed that a third of the providers only intended on being in business for a short time. 80% said their business was profitable when they closed. Additional questions focused on the reason for closure, which fell into two large categories. The first category, the number one reason cited for closure, was actually personal reasons. These included things like the combined challenge of low income, long hours, and physically demanding work, pursuing another career, and medical reasons. The second reason cited for closure was due to what providers generally labeled as increased regulation. These included things like the cost of operating the business, the challenges of being self-employed, training hours that must be completed outside the already 10 to 12 hour workday, as well as the cost of training, and intrusive rules such as being able to smoke in the home. We asked providers about the supports they received for their program. Nearly all of the providers said the supports were very helpful. These supports included things like parent-aware, participation in the child care adult food program, being part of a local child care association, and business supports. And finally, we asked what other supports would have been helpful in keeping their doors open. They suggested things like peer support, such as mentoring, more accessible training, including more online options, licensing staff that were less arbitrary and punitive, more financial supports, and a better process for getting families referred to their program. Additional analysis was also completed regarding parent-aware participation and the rate of closure in family child care providers between January 2015 and January 17. The results showed that non-parent-aware participating providers had a closure rate three times the closure rate of parent-aware participating providers. And I'm going to say that one more time because I have to think about it. So again, the results showed that non-parent-aware participating providers had a closure rate of almost three times the closure rate of parent-aware participating providers in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. This survey is just one effort to capture the reasons why Minnesota is seeing a decline in the licensed family child care providers, but we believe it represents other efforts. As a result of the survey and its analysis, Think Small and Generation Next are leveraging existing work that is funded both by DHS and philanthropic support to focus on addressing many of these issues in an effort to begin increasing the number of high-quality early learning options for families. Specifically, in January 2017, we implemented what we call the Parent Aware Retention Incentive Program for licensed family child care providers in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And you have a one-pager on that as well. And the one statistic I want to pull out of that is that when we served those recipients, 89% of them said that this retention incentive directly affected their participation in Parent Aware, which, again, links back to that closure rate. In addition, we are now exploring future efforts that include new strategies to recruit providers into the field, the use of technology to support providers' professional development, and additional financial supports. In closing, while we collectively may not have all the answers as to why Minnesota has seen a child care shortage, the survey does serve as a starting place for potential solutions, and I have shared just a few that we have come up with. I look forward to working with this committee and all of you to invest in what we know works and is what's in the best interest of children.
All right, thank you. All right, so next we're going to have Karen White. Karen works out of Bemidji, and she's the Vice President for Programs. And there's been some recent stories in the Star Tribune and in community newspapers across the state that have focused on the child care crisis facing outstate Minnesota. And so Karen is here to tell her story.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Yes, we are the Minnesota Initiative Foundation serving the 12 counties in northwest Minnesota, so kind of Hubbard County, north to the Canadian border, and to North Dakota. We've been working in early child care and education for almost 15 years, and I can honestly say today that any conversations we are having in communities about how they are doing is dominated by the lack of child care available and the impact it is having on families and employers. Since summer of 2017, we have been working with 8 communities with another at least 4 communities to get started in 2018. And some of the 8 communities that we've been working in, we've been doing surveys and listening sessions with providers, families, and employers. The top 3 reasons we are hearing that providers are quitting is, firstly, they do not feel respected as or supported as professionals. They are isolated from other adults, and they feel like others view them as babysitters rather than child care and education providers and small business owners, which they are. Secondly, the long hours that they work. They are opening early in the morning to accommodate the needs of 1 or 2 families and then staying open later to accommodate the needs of different families. According to First Children's Finance, they are staying open an average of 55 hours per week, plus then needing to do paperwork, cleaning, prepping food, and attending training on top of that. And also, the pay is low and there are no benefits. According to Deed's latest job vacancy survey, the median starting wage for the Northwest and West Central region has climbed to over $13 an hour, and we have over 10,000 jobs open, which is great. But with child care providers making on average less than $9 per hour, it is clear that we will likely continue to see child care providers close and take jobs elsewhere. We also hear quite a bit about increasing regulation as a factor, especially the new requirements to have minors 13 and older fingerprinted. Also mentioned is the requirement to turn back if a child falls asleep in a stroller, the protective gear that must be worn and have available to handle bodily fluids, and needing a comprehensive emergency preparedness plan. Providers feel that the low pay is not worth the headaches that go along with the regulations. With the median household income at $49,000 for our region, according to Minnesota Compass, raising their rates really isn't an option for providers in our region. At the average rate of $125 per week per child, one child is 13% of a household before tax income. When we survey families, most say that the cost of child care is a significant struggle for them. We've also been hearing that center-based care is particularly difficult in our rural, remote communities for 2 primary reasons. One, it is very difficult to hire the staff with the education credentials that is necessary for licensing. Most of the individuals with the right education are hired up by our school districts and Head Start programs. The available workforce to fill the staffing vacancies is just not available. Even if a community had the available workforce, the business model rarely works. Either the center needs to have too many children, 100 plus, to cash flow, which is just not supported in our small populations, or they need to raise their rates way above what the families in the community can afford. Either way, the business model collapses. Our rural communities rely on family-licensed child care providers in order to survive. We have multiple counties without a single center. Also, with this reliance on family-licensed child care providers, finding open slots for infants and toddlers is especially difficult. And we are also starting to investigate the potential impact of voluntary pre-K on our family-licensed child care providers. The concern is that if schools open to all-day, everyday preschool, we will see a large number of family-licensed child care providers close because of lack of income. They cannot survive financially on infants and toddlers and part-time school-aged children. We are hearing firsthand about the consequences this shortage is having on our region's families and employers. We have about 16 employers engaged across the 8 communities trying to help identify solutions. They are at the table because they hear that people that they want to hire are turning down jobs because they cannot find child care. Anderson Fabrics and Black Ducks could bring 70 jobs to that community, but they believe that the lack of child care will impact their availability to hire the workforce. And during one conversation, Christy McFarlane, former HR manager with Life Care Medical in Roseau, said, "If any one of our employers wanted to ramp up right now, how would they do it? I don't know how they would be able to do it because there wouldn't be any child care available." That's sad for growth in the community. And we have a couple of different businesses looking to start open soon. How are they going to find people? And a survey response in Black Duck really said it all. I just had to quit my job today because I have no child care. But possibly the most concerning consequence became evident from a survey in Roseau County. A whopping 56% of respondents said that the lack of child care had impacted their family planning, the decision whether or when to have more children. Those children that these families are not having are our community's future students and future workforce that won't be there, and that's heartbreaking to hear. A few suggestions from our perspective. We want to thank you for the DEED Minnesota Child Care Grant. We are a grant recipient, and we plan to use the grant to help seed community-led solutions in six of the communities that we are working in. In these communities, multiple stakeholders are involved in finding viable solutions, and the stakeholders are viewing this as a community problem, not just a provider and parent or family problem. Additional funding would be helpful. We have at least 12 communities in our region with child care gaps of over 100 slots. Implement voluntary pre-K as a mixed delivery with resources open to more organizations than just the schools. The schools are able to share the resources, but some estimates show that just 1% have done so far. If family licensed child care providers are left out of this mix, we will have a full-blown crisis on our hands, without a doubt. Deliberate Regulation 9502.0367 with regards to the number of children allowed to be cared for by two adults under the Family Licensed Child Care Regulation, which is currently a maximum of 14 children. Without jeopardizing the health and safety of the children, can a new regulation be written? Rural communities need a viable child care business model solution that fits between the single adult family license, which is 10 or 12 children max, depending on the particular license, and the center model, which is 50-plus to cash flow. And suspend the requirement required to go into effect in 2018 that requires fingerprinting of minors, 13 or older, living in the household of the family licensed child care provider, or that may have unsupervised access with the children in care, such as visiting grandchildren. We believe that child care providers will close down before subjecting their own children to this requirement. In closing, according to the Center for Rural Policy and Development, Northwest Minnesota needs another 2,700 child care slots, a growth of 39% in capacity. Many strategies will be needed to close this gap. Our communities are ready and engaged in tackling this complex problem, but we need help. Thank you again.
Thank you. All right. So I stated that before you showed up. Yeah, so after. Next up, we've got Jess Myers. She works out of St. Paul. Hi.
Never happened before, ever once.
You know, that's what happens when you assume, I guess. Minnesota Child Care Association. So once again, you guys, we are going to be taking a close look at the Jensen Settlement and Positive Supports Rule. I've lost count of how many times we have discussed that. But here we are again, and we're going to discuss how it applies to child care providers. I am, and we all should be concerned about this rule being applied to child care programs based on its initial intent, training required, and additional administrative burden put on these private programs. Last fall, I co-chaired the Task Force on Access to Affordable Child Care with Senator Wicklund, and we heard a lot of testimony from the child care providers about this rule, and that task force included looking into the applicability of the rule for child care settings as one of its regulatory recommendations. There is a real concern that the rule places an undue burden on providers, especially given the very small number of children with disabilities covered by the rule in typical child care settings. Due to this burden, there is also a concern that enforcement of the rule will cause many of the child care programs to restrict access to families of children with developmental disabilities, children who we want to be in inclusive settings, and families for whom options are already limited. So in short, I fear that the real possibility of this rule will actually decrease access to child care, which, of course, is the opposite of what this committee is looking for. So with that, go ahead, Mr. Myers.
Thank you, Chair Franson. My name is Jess Myers. I am with Ewald Consulting, and I am a government relations representative for the Minnesota Child Care Association. We represent about 250 child care centers across the state. These range from single programs to large multi-site organizations. Child care providers have been concerned about the interaction of the positive supports rule and our work since first learning about it in the summer of 2015. Now, the rule stems from the Jensen Settlement Agreement, which settled a lawsuit alleging that adult residents of a state-run treatment center were subject to illegal and unconstitutional things like seclusion and restraint. We're talking about handcuffs. We're talking about leg shackles, serious things that do not apply to young children in any setting. The agreement's scope refers only to that treatment center, to two additional adult foster care programs, and to other, quote, state-operated locations serving those with developmental disabilities with severe behavioral problems. Child care providers are obviously private businesses licensed by the state. They are not state-operated organizations. But in an attempt to change the culture of those serving persons with developmental disabilities, all provisions of the agreement were administratively applied to all DHS licensed programs, which includes licensed child care providers. Now, I want to be clear. MCCA does not disagree with the intent of the positive supports rule. There should be protections for individuals with developmental disabilities. And the alleged abuse of vulnerable adults that precipitated the lawsuit needed to come to light. It needed to be stopped. And future experiences like this need to be prevented, absolutely. However, compliance with this rule, which seems to have been intended for a very specific population of adults with developmental disabilities in state-run programs, places a tremendous burden on child care providers. DHS has done a good job of trying to reduce some of the confusion in the child care field by explaining that only a very specific population of children meet the, quote, developmental disability or related condition that triggers compliance with the PSR. Now, training is our biggest concern in terms of quantity, costs, and applicability to our field. Child care providers are required to assess all mandatory positive supports training before serving any child who meets the criteria covered by the rule. This training is 8 to 14 hours of specific instruction with significant content unrelated to the work of childcare. Appropriate and inappropriate uses of shackles, for example, handcuffs, chemical restraints or medications to control behavior, solitary confinement, again, things that would never apply to a young child. Much of this is explicitly prohibited in childcare regulations already. The training does not fit what childcare providers do in their daily interactions with young children, and does not appear to be developmentally appropriate for the ages served in our settings. Now, the training is required of all staff who provide direct services to a person or a child with a developmental disability or a related condition, and also to those who have responsibility for developing, implementing, monitoring, supervising, or evaluating positive support strategies. Basically, every staff member who comes into contact with a child or who supervises, plans, or implements things for that child must complete the training. As I mentioned, the core training is 8 hours. An additional 4 hours are required for certain staff and an additional 2 hours for others. We're looking at requiring up to 14 hours of additional training on things that rarely apply to the type of setting and age group we're talking about in this child care. Now, for example, the cost to train all staff within a large provider such as New Horizon Academy to comply with the rule is estimated at over $538,000 just in the first year. This burden is especially significant given the tiny percentage of children served by a provider like New Horizon who are covered by this rule. New Horizon has roughly 10,000 children in their care, and of these, only 0.2% of these children currently enrolled have the specific disabilities to which the positive supports rule applies. In addition to training, there are increased documentation and administration requirements. The training is the biggest hurdle, but there is much more to it than that. Now, we have already heard from many members that the costs, both in money and in time, represent an unreasonable accommodation in order to serve, again, a very small number of children affected by the positive supports rule. Many providers have also said that they would need to severely restrict or refuse to serve children who present the diagnosis covered by the rule or who obtain such a diagnosis while they're enrolled in the program. I'm not talking about flat-out discrimination against children and families. That, of course, is illegal. I'm talking about the inability of child care providers to meet these requirements in the context of the staffing ratio, training, and other requirements already in place under licensing. The Minnesota Disability Law Center has helpful resources for families of children with disabilities who are searching for care. Now, this flies in the face, as you mentioned, Chair Franzen, of expanding access to community settings and services available to these children and their families. We want children of all abilities to be in the least restrictive community setting possible. Restricting child care access for affected children and families is a major concern, and delaying their access is another concern. A provider might choose not to get the required training if they currently serve no children covered by the positive supports rule. Reasonable approach. If a family of such a child inquires about enrollment, however, the staff would need to complete those 8 to 14 hours of training before serving the child. And keep in mind, that's all staff. That's not just one or two people that you can designate as experts in this area. This could lead to providers telling families that they may have to wait months to enroll in their program. The situation could keep children out of early learning opportunities, and it could keep parents out of the workforce. Now, MCCA has worked with DHS since the rule was announced to address these concerns. DHS staff have been willing partners, and they continue to be. But our members cannot be in limbo forever, and they will start getting licensing citations if these often unattainable requirements, are not met. The real losers, we fear, will be the children and families turned away from the very supports and services they seek. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Myers. Appreciate it. Next up, we have Jim Koppel. He's the Assistant Commissioner of Children and Family Services of DHS, and he is here to present us on the Federal Child Care Development Block Grant requirements that were not enacted in 2017.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Jim Koppel, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. You have a handout that kind of I'll just read through with you to clarify what the major child care system program changes needed to conform with the federal law that we have been talking about for the last couple of years. Last year there was considerable progress made in a number of areas conforming to that law. And what I'd like to do today is just update you on the remaining areas that are needed for conformity, but also to improve the, many of them just to improve the environment for child care. And the first one is the biggest one in terms of money. It's updating maximum rates. So we pay at the 25th percentile, which means in Minnesota, we do a survey of rates, and if you score those rates, you know, providers fall into the lowest and the highest, 1 to 100. We pay, this is a simplification but pretty accurate, is we pay up to the 25th percentile, the 25th, if there were 100, 25 providers would get all of their rates, and then it would go down from there. The challenge for us that under the federal law is not the 25th percentile, which is a low percentile to pay for reimbursement, but to base that 25th percentile on the most recent market survey. And our rates currently are based, last increase was in 2014, but it was based on a 2011 market survey. We do that market survey every 2 years. There'll be one available this summer. And so what the federal conformity would be conforming to the most recent market survey, 25th percentile, but that market survey. That's going to be a significant cost, but also will bring us into conformity and improve reimbursement rates for providers.
Mr. Koppel, when you say significant cost, could you just throw a dollar amount out so we have an idea?
You know, Madam Chair, thank you. I don't have my fiscal note in front of me from last year. I want to say it's in the neighborhood of $40 million a year. Would that be about right?
Thank you.
So
33 starting in 2020.
$33 million. It went fully implemented. Thank you. And then subsequently there'd be increases as we do market survey every 2 years. So we would increase it every 2 years. Madam Chair, is that significant? Was I accurate?
Continue on.
The next one I would go to is revised payment methods. This is not something that requires legislation, but it is a federal requirement, and this is a task force that we'll be setting up. Right now we pay hourly, daily, weekly. The federal payment system wants us to move toward a part-time, full-time payment method unless we can show that our hourly, daily, weekly rate fits and is accomplishing the same goals as their suggested language. So we will look at both, and we will have to move to whatever is determined to be the best way to go. But it's not a statute change, but it is something we'll be working on this year. Next, program improvements. This is an area we did a lot of work on last year, and the legislature did a lot of work around 12-month eligibility for families. But there are still a couple things left. The elimination of the 6-month limit on portability pool. So what happens is that a family who moves between counties continues eligibility for 6 months. But then if there was a waiting list there, they would lose their child care and go on a waiting list. So this would end that so that they would continue to receive child care in the county they moved to. It would allow families to receive MFIP 1 month out of the last 6 months to receive transition year care. So currently some families lose eligibility when they stop getting MFIP cash assistance. What we're trying to do there is if a family hasn't been full-time or a full on MFIP for 6 months and then gets a job and needs child care transition year, if they've only been on one of those 6 months and they got a job, they wouldn't get the transition year child care. So it's really helps us move families toward self-sufficiency and brings child care when needed when a transition the family is making. And then allowing families to reach the age limit at 13 years old for most children, 18 if a child has special needs, to continue receiving assistance until redetermination. So right now in 12-month redetermination that we passed last year, the thing that's left out of that, I mean, your income can change, things can change, hours can change, and you don't need to go through a redetermination process. But if your child turns 13 or with a disability 15, they would lose child care. We want that to be part of the redetermination process. So at the end of the 12 months, they would look at that, but not during the 12 months. That's clear. Next is to create an expedited application process for homeless families. This is a process application. We would process applications within 5 days, allow families up to 3 months to gather required verification. That's just a way to get children into child care faster and allow families who may not have all that information organized to get it together over the next 3 months. Next is expanding due process rights for child care providers. Right now, the rights of the only rights, appeal rights for providers need to be initiated by families. And this would transfer appeal rights from families to providers when action are taken against providers. So it basically gives providers appeal rights and provides due process for all adverse actions through fair hearing, administrative review, or consolidated hearing with licensing. And lastly, ensure federal health and safety requirements are met. This requires specific training and a scheduled annual visit for legal, non-licensed providers caring for children not related to them. Training requirements replace the current requirements. Require out-of-state providers to meet federal health and safety requirements to receive child care assistance payments. So this would be affect providers operating in other states but serving Minnesota children, and eliminate the option to pay legal non-licensed providers before a background study is completed. This option is not currently in use. It would just be removing it, but we don't do that now. So it wouldn't be a change in practice, but it would just be change in statute. And that concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Koppel. First, I think that Representative Stanseed has been begging to approve the minutes from February 27th, 2017.
I do move the minutes.
All right. Do we have a motion to approve them, then? Or you did?
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, so can we approve them? Yep.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. All right, so that's taken care of. I can sign this because my wonderful committee administrator would not let me sign them previously.
You need to vote on it.
Approved. Oh, we need to vote on those. Sorry, we're out of mode of practice. Okay, so, all right, let's vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, any opposed? All right. All right, now that we have heard testimony and we've heard the human side of it, as well as some statistical sides, we are going to call everybody up that has testified and have them sit around the testifying table, make it a little easier for those of us that have questions so you don't have to go up and down, up and down. So you can take a moment to get close, comfortable and cozy. And, yep, you can just pull a chair up, too, if you want. Absolutely. And do we have a list of people who have questions?
No,
two more.
Yep, Representative Flanagan, do you want to go first?
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first question is for, and I'm sorry we don't have your name written down here, from the Northwest Minnesota Foundation.
Yes. Hi, Karen White.
Hi, Karen. Ms. White. Ms. White, I have several questions. I would love to just set up a conversation with you also offline. But some of the questions that I have with regards to, you talked about additional funding, that was needed, and, if, for example, you got the funding, you know, you could wave a magic wand, you got the funding that you needed as you're looking at these additional 2,700 spots that are needed, what would that amount be, or what would that look like? What would that allow you to do?
Yes, what we've been trying to look at is trying to have seed funding to have available to help in the communities with gaps of 100 slots or more. And our latest gap analysis work that we've done says that we have about 12 of those communities. So, you know, 360,000. We were able to secure 90,000 through the deed grant
mm-hmm.
towards that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at about another 270,000 would be our request.
Okay.
And we're working with a lot of communities and really letting communities really think about the best viable solutions in their communities. And looking at funding might go towards building remodel, might go towards initial staffing as an employer-based program might get up and going. We're also looking at helping provide business training to existing providers so that they feel more comfortable with the business side of what they're doing and can help increase their income through different practices. So those are just a few of the approaches that we're looking at.
That's great. Madam Chair, Ms. Waite, could you also talk about the number of children? This is a... I, admittedly, right, this is a tricky issue for us to talk about, especially as it relates to safety. But I'm not sure if you had mentioned it before. You talked about it, but could you just reiterate, if you're looking at numbers, what are some of the things that providers are telling you for the number of appropriate adult or provider to child ratios?
Yeah, more of the conversations we've been having have been around trying to find a way to have it be more financially feasible for two adults to work together in a business partnership. Mm-hmm. We think that that would increase the attractiveness of the profession if they could have a business partner, have somebody else that they get to, another adult that they get to spend the day with, share some of the stresses and so forth. And currently, the way that the regulation is, it's just not enough money to split between the two. So that's really where a lot of our conversations have been around.
Madam Chair, I have one more question. And that question is with regards to, and it's something that Commissioner Koppel alluded to, but CCAP reimbursement rates. Could you talk about that a little bit and what that would mean for, one, to ideally fully fund and forecast the child care assistance program, but two, just the provider reimbursement rates and knowing that a lot of providers who care deeply about children in the community are taking some of these kids, many of these children at a loss. So.
Yes. Yep. In our community, I mean, we have a number of communities with high poverty rates, and a number who rely on those assistants to have children in child care. And certainly we would be all supportive of increasing those reimbursement rates. It would help with the low income that child care providers are facing right now. And, you know, and we also hear about the delay in payment and that's a significant. So if that timeliness could be better, you know, I get a paycheck every 2 weeks and I rely on that to cash flow. And if that didn't come into my bank account regularly, it would hurt. So I can empathize with how those providers are feeling.
Thank you. And my hope is that we can spend some time, hopefully, with your stakeholders and talk about, there clearly are some of the things that you mentioned or conversations that we've had with folks across the state, but would love to be able to visit with you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Stancy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, and thank you all for your testimonies this morning. My question is to any of you, all of you. In terms of training, I'm wondering, first of all, is there a difference between home-based child care and family-based home or family-based child care versus center-based in terms of the training you're required to do on an annual basis?
Sorry, I'm doing the lean over. So again, Cisa Keller, Senior Vice President, Think Small. So Madam Chair and Representatives, there is a difference, and I can, the DHS colleagues can jump in on this more. Center-based care and, family-based care are actually two different rules. Rule 2, is the regulations for licensed family child care providers, where Rule 3 is for, center-based care. And on average, the requirements for training, for licensed family child care is right about 16 hours on an annual basis. Center-based care is about 40 hours on an annual basis. These include things, these are mostly health and safety, first aid, CPR, safe sleep practices, as well as then a variety of other options, you know, that providers can choose from.
Thank you. And then my next question would be, in terms of training, how available is the training to you, both as a family-based daycare provider or a center-based daycare provider? In my experience with the people that I've spoken with, it's very difficult. Oftentimes, some of the trainings take place during the day, making it very difficult to get there. And what is offered on an evening or weekend, there's often great travel requirements required.
Yeah, I can talk to that just in, as a system, but then I think the providers can add some additional context. And I do want to clarify that center base, the 40 hours, is per staff person, not per program. So I think that's important. I think this is an area when we talk about training that we are absolutely on a continuous improvement. There is a lot of space to do this better and offer more options. So to your point, at the most basic, is it near and available both geographically, time-wise, for providers to be able to do that, especially family child care providers, as you're talking about their long working hours. And so I think many entities, including the Department of Human Services, the Child Care Aware System, are really trying to look at what those options are. Currently, there are basically three ways in which you get training. You can do face-to-face training, in which you sign up for a training, you go on a Saturday morning, a Tuesday afternoon, and you do the training. You can do something. There's online training options through a platform called Eager to Learn, in which, it's a scheduled Tuesday afternoon, Saturday morning type situation, but that's an online option. That has obviously issues when you get into Greater Minnesota, and we talk about broadband, but that is an option. That's one area that we can look to expand. And then there's a third option, and that is called Anytime Learning, in which it's more of a webinar-based type thing, and you do it at your own pace. So I think what I would like to highlight is I think from a training side of things, those of us that are delivering training are trying to find ways to meet providers where they are and actually support them. But there is a lot of area in which we can improve upon that, and we're constantly trying to explore what those options are. But I'm happy to turn it over to the providers for them to answer as well.
Representative Franz and Representative Sandsteed, from a center perspective, this is actually one of the challenges with the transparency for licensing. Last year, as part of the statutory changes, there were changes made for the training over almost 40 hours a week on average. And part of that details very specific things, such as child development, the history of child development, positive behavior, intervention type things. But the statute is very clear. It says you must have training in each of these areas. And when I met with the deputy commissioner, Ms. Wagner, she said that it was, and on the training sheet, even that the DHS provides, it's you may. So I have a real trust issue with the wording, seeing as the preponderance of evidence seems to dictate I can't win no matter what I do. So that would be great to find out. Additionally, as a teacher, I have to have 25 hours per year for training, and now I have to have 40, and I have a master's degree. So I'm not sure how that works.
As far as family child care goes, the part of the problem that we're seeing is the redundancy of training. There are certain trainings that are required, and after 15 years of taking behavior guidance, and it's maybe one or two classes, you're not learning anything new. It's really hard to stay focused and to follow the class when you've heard it 15 times already. The online classes they speak of, a lot of times, the classes will be, there's a schedule where you have to sign up by a certain date. Even though you're taking this class online, safe pace to yourself, well, then you have a class that is due by a certain month, and you didn't sign up by the 5th of March, and you needed it by April, but yet you can't sign up for that class again until sometime in June. This is an online class. There is no studying with other people, so why is there these cutoffs for registering for these classes? And then if you're taking a class like CPR, first aid, they need to be taken face-to-face. This time of year, when mine is due in March, a lot of times classes are shut down because of weather. There's a lack of people who are signing up for a class, so a class will be canceled at that point. So there's a lot of things that go into the reasons why it's more difficult for us to. And I won't take a vacation day, and I'm going to be really honest, to take training for daycare. I do it after hours, I do it on a weekend, or I do it online. The ones that are offered during the day, child care providers deserve a day off, and we deserve to take our vacation to actually have vacation and spend time with our families. And so those are some of the issues that we deal with. There's a lot of restrictions with MNCPD that the trainers there's only certain things they can say. They cannot go off script. There's a lot of restrictions for trainers coming in. We're having problems with wonderful out-of-state trainers that we've had that no longer can come in because of new regulations that have been put forth. So there's a lot of problems with the training system besides just the hours of training.
Thank you.
I just recently, in January, met with some center-based providers in the Fergus Falls area in that region. And one of the issues they talked about was staff qualifications. And indeed, they've had to pay to have somebody take a ceramics class so that they could get that person qualified in order to work. They said that staff qualifications are very confusing. The post-secondary courses is not complete, and just very frustrating that they are not hiring the best talent. What they're hiring is what do you got on this post-secondary list? And it seems like they said the government is more interested in a list than talent in the classroom. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I am encouraged by the contingent from the department here, and it's very informative what portions of the testimony prompts typing and texting, so I hopefully have a better understanding of the, you know, what the department's getting. Plus, they are definitely paying attention to many of the testifiers. I think the department and staff could work together to get us some updated information, basically graphics providing across the years types of centers, public schools, count of licensed family child care, unlicensed, so we see what the trends are, have that also overlaid with the number of enrollees, because as the mix of different types, it does affect how many slots there are, and then approximately what the population in the band that would be, the age group for that, so we can maybe scale and maybe try to analyze what's happening with the trends. I know some of that's been done by, I think, small for a portion, but I think we really need to, have that background information in the discussions. It'd be nice to have also, probably from the department, across the year, what are the required training hours, so we can see where things have changed. What are the total number of rules and regulations, so we can see where those things have shifted, and that might help us get some enlightenment as to the causes. I'm not sure, but I believe in the past the department has had access to similar general trend information for national and then regional, like, what do the upper Midwest states have? And we have seen snapshots of different regions of the state, because that's where the crisis appears to be. I think it was referred to as deserts of, centers and providers that are really handicapping. It's probably going to be, a lot of this is offline. I want to try to understand when they're talking about regulations, and I've been through a lot of the department meetings with providers, and they've gone over, we were cited for our teenage daughter had something left out in the bathroom behind a closed door upstairs, and we were cited. Frankly, there's been a trend to have public schools, and it's very handy in some locations, provide child care before and after school. And if the same rigor was imposed there, the background checks, the required training on shackles, et cetera, and then also on every room in that building and facility, is there some inappropriate thing such as a plunger, et cetera, in any of the bathrooms, any of the other rooms, because they're in the same structure, and that's the type of rigor that's imposed. Even if you have a separate area by the providers, they still go anywhere in that house through any closed door to find, citation. It'd be nice to understand the delta between, I personally think there's a difference between adults and children. And so some of the things that were brought up, it'd be very good for this committee to see where you delineate and where there are special cases for some situations and not others. The lay of the land would be pretty useful. And then what I've heard from providers regards to the keeping of the photos, especially of the younger members of the household, it's not just fingerprints. We're told, well, they're going to get rid of the fingerprints for the younger. It doesn't go to the FBI, but we're retaining the photos. You know, anyone, again, that's in the household, there's issues with physical posting versus you have an accessibility online and the in perpetuity of some of the stuff. Multi-county repeat fees, if the department can illuminate, because my understanding from the discussions in the legislative intent and committee was part of the reason of having the department take over the background checks, besides the federal compliance, is now it's at a statewide level, and if you've got somebody that's subbing across four or five counties, which happens, each county is extracting those fees from the providers, and you know, to me, that's not the legislative intent, and it's not good for providers, which several testifiers have illuminated the very small you know, amount of income that they receive when everything's taken out. But you know, it is very confusing. It seems almost as if there's a, you're looking for justification to implement an agenda. And it almost seems as if there's a move to force out and close the family child care providers in favor of, you know, I don't know, you know, moving it into, you know, public schools. And there have been nations that have practiced the cradle to grad, I wasn't going to mention that, but of where the state supplants the parents. And frankly, what I'm hearing about the lack of teamwork and feeling as if they're, you know, one group against the other, you need to, as a state government, provide support and be part of a team. And I think that's what we heard last year, crying out for a team. Work together, because that will provide for the children and the families. And, you know, if there's a, you know, response on how the department has improved the atmosphere and the teamwork, cohesion, I'd like to hear that, but I understand a lot of this will have to come, you know, offline. But if there's anyone of the you know, providers that can mention some positive steps in the last year about improving that teamwork relationship, I'd like to hear some good news. Madam Chair, I think we were enlightened there.
Yes, I did not hear anything. All right. I have. Yeah. Come on up. Hello, Regina. You want to state your name for the record? And
certainly, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Regina Wagner. I am the Deputy Inspector General of the Licensing Division at the Department of Human Services. I apologize for not being here for the first part and the most of it. I'm also engaged in our department's interagency collaborative with the Office of Health Facilities on some of the elder abuse, and so I was asked to be down at that hearing subcommittee and Representative Thiel that started this morning. So haven't figured out how to bilocate on two very important topics affecting our regulated industry, but I was asked to come up, and what I would like to do is to at least more immediately respond to Representative Quam, but in general wanted to talk just at a high level about the work that I have been leading my staff in, particularly in the last 8 to 12 months. Since the session has ended, the legislative session, we have embarked, and I don't think that I'm overstating if I say that it is an unprecedented effort within our licensing regulated teams to go out to the communities and actually engage with our license holders, particularly in our family child care setting. As you have heard me talk about previously and know from your own providers and your own county staff, that there are our delegated licensing system, where the county licensor for the licensed family providers is that primary licensing relationship. But we have heard in the last few years very, very clearly from providers, particularly licensed family providers, that they see a value and a need for the state to be more involved in that relationship and in that exchange of information. And so since roughly August, we have been to almost certainly more than a dozen, and probably pushing closer to 20 communities with our outreach presentations specifically targeted for licensed family child care providers. We've been to Morris. We've been to Laverne. We have been to Olmsted County, Duluth, Grand Rapids, Bemidji, Alexandria. We've met with child care centers in many of these communities. We've been to Stearns County. We've been out to Litchfield, Meeker County. We can certainly provide you with a list of that. We've been between centers and family child care providers. We've been to over 25 communities. We probably haven't said no to a single request we've gotten. We have done our family child care meetings in the evenings, 7 to 9, generally. We've accommodated whatever the providers have asked for. We've made background study staff available to come and be able to answer those questions. And the response has been extremely positive. We have had providers individually, as part of the presentation, afterwards come up and say, thank you. Thank you for coming out here. This is what we need. I've told them that we are committed to coming back 2-3 times a year to provide some updates and information, respecting that they have their own needs for information and collaboration building, and they have all welcomed that suggestion. We've said that with center groups. There are groups that have met monthly that we weren't even aware of. Historically, the work of the regulators has been to kind of keep our eyes down and be regulators, and I think what these conversations in the past few years and the leadership on this subcommittee in particular has shown is that that's not enough, and that isn't going to help us to move the needle forward on it. We have heard many of the sort of pain points and concerns that have been raised by these testifiers, and during the last few legislative sessions come up. We've heard new things come up. We've heard people try to encourage us to look differently at it. I think what I have heard from providers is that both our Rule 2 and our Rule 3 are old, and we believe that some of what we are all living in is rules that are 20 and 30 years old that have not been updated, have not been modified, have not kept pace with where providers are moving. We have variance authority. Variance allows us to give an exception to a requirement in the rule. For some of the workforce issues, the staffing, the qualifications, we use that, and we use it a lot. I oversee more than just child care centers. We have the variance authority for certain things delegated to the commissioner and therefore to our staff. Child care centers in particular, we grant more than 3,000 variances a year. Those are requests that come in from the license holder. More than half of those are related to staff qualifications. We think our rule has some flexibility. Sometimes that flexibility people find of concern. How can a teacher oversee a classroom if how can a director oversee a classroom if they don't have a teaching degree? Others have said you need that flexibility. we try to look at what the rule says and how our variance authority can get us there. I think that when I speak to communities and providers in particular, and particularly family providers, and say, I think it's time for some, you know, a collaborative effort to look at updating our rules rather than going in piecemeal to address individual things, there's a lot of support for that. And I know that that has been on one of the policy agenda items that it looked like a presentation handout for today, and we would welcome being some piece of that conversation. So I want to assure this committee that this is getting a significant amount of my time. I have personally been to most, not all, but most of those greater Minnesota and even the metro family child care providers to really hear for myself firsthand what their concerns are, where they are kind of giving us a nod, but quite honestly, where they're pushing us forward. We try to have our county staff that are there. We often have one or more county licensors for that county there. We often have a supervisor, if not a director there. The partnership that we are moving towards building, even as we staff up from last session, which we are very grateful for the legislature providing us the additional funding, we believe that we will finally have the actual boots on the ground, literally, to be able to begin to make a difference. We are putting more information on our website. Some information we've given previously, the legislative task force from 2 years ago, we had a lot of information related to what are the training requirements across the rules. We try to be aware of where we should have similarities. We understand that having things be more similar than different between a family-based and a center-based does make sense, but sometimes there are legitimate differences. So part of my response is to both apologize for not being able to be here for all of it in the beginning, but also to tell you that there is a significant amount of work going on. Representative Quam, other legislators have been able to be there. Some, it doesn't always happen. We really just tried to say we want to respect the request that comes in from the provider group. They've got their agendas often scheduled out, but we really want to be as accessible as we can. I think that's very different than what we have done in the past. I've tried to push my staff a little bit to understand that's an important piece, that even though we're regulators, we need to be able to be there. We are in some sort of a relationship with our providers because we've given them a license. And so I think our role needs to be more than just eyes down. We're trying to get more data informed. I understood that there's been some testimony about some folks looking aggregate. I know some comments here about us looking at our data, and we really hope that we can begin to use our data and offer that up in formal and informal ways for not only the legislators but the providers, and clearly for ourselves to become a little bit more data-driven. So if there is any specific questions, I'm certainly happy to answer them, but I wanted to at least acknowledge some of the work that we have been doing. It's very significant, different for us. We're seeing the positive results from it, and I'm personally very committed to maintaining that outreach and exposure directly to our providers. And it has been very eye-opening for me to have folks come up after and talk with me short-term, long-term, what they've struggled with. Many are very supportive of some of the work we're doing. And by and large, a lot of them simply acknowledge that we're all in this together, and the dialogue is an important part. And so these committee hearings allow us that opportunity, and we're trying as well to kind of keep that work moving forward. So thank you.
Elizabeth? I would like to respond if possible.
Sure.
I will. Jeez, this is an emotional roller coaster today. I have met a number of times with the Department of Police State. Oh, I'm sorry. Elizabeth Bangert, Here We Grow Early Childhood Center. Representative Franson, I met a number of times with the Department of Human Services, and I understand that we are trying to move forward. However, we must acknowledge the past. There was a Greater Mankato Task Force meeting a few Saturdays ago, and yet every time the hard questions are asked, no one seems to want to answer them. I am not excited about there being additional licensors. That is 32 total people who have no consistency. That does not excite me based on the data that I'm reviewing. That terrifies me. I walk into my center every day terrified to go to work. Haley, my colleague, who would want this job? No one. No one would want this job. And furthermore, do you want to talk about transparency? Let's give credit where credit is due. The handbook that was provided to family and center providers this year is required by statute. That's not something they came up with on their own. That's a statutory requirement now for them to tell us what the new regulations are. And since we're being completely transparent, and I'm totally putting myself on the line, let's talk about the fact that you had an opportunity to be transparent, and you left out the one statute that holds you accountable. Nowhere in their handbook did you talk about the new statute that dictates everything you have to report to the legislature. Nowhere was that mentioned. I am sorry, but we need change. This has been 5 years of a living hell for me that I would have never entered into. And tonight, at 7 p.m., I have to drive to Olivia, Minnesota, where I do consulting, and stand before a group of people trying to save their town and their community, determining how to get more family providers, or somehow finagle a center there, and stand up there and pretend like everything's sunshine and roses. And I won't do it anymore. I have to tell them the hard truth. It's hard to start a center. It's hard to be a family provider. And something has to change. I'm tired of sugarcoating it.
Julie?
State your name for the record.
Julie Seidel, Public Policy Director of MACCP. There's a couple of things that Reggie Wagner stated that I would like to give, I guess, the provider's point of view on it. I happened to arrange one of the meetings with DHS in Anoka County, and the meeting got quite heated by providers. Providers were very frustrated. Providers were asking questions. We're still not getting direct answers from DHS. And the one thing that really struck me and has bothered me to this day is when we asked the question about why our children were classified as child care staff people. And Reggie's comment was, we didn't know the language we wrote, that's what it meant. I'm finding that really hard to believe, because the people that write that legislation right on their business card says legislative specialist. If I, general public, can read that and know what it means, you know darn well when they wrote it, they knew what it meant. We've been asking for months what's going to happen with our fingerprints. We're told, we don't know. We don't know what the FBI is going to do. Well, nobody's going to keep them. Well, we're going to keep the photographs. Not until I received a letter from the Senate Advisory Committee did it clearly state in a response by DHS that they're going to work with the BCA to change Minnesota statute in order to keep our fingerprints in the FBI for the wrap-back system. This is the problem that we're having with DHS. Be forthcoming. There's a lot of things that have changed that if there would have been an open conversation with family child care, the changes would have been easier. We're okay with change, but we would like it done where it's not a punitive, damaging change to family child care. I'm not sure where these dozens of providers are telling DHS that things are getting better, because they're not getting better. There's not transparency. We're not getting questions answered. I sent a question 14 days ago to Jim Janicek, because a licensor told a provider she cannot turn the hot water off in her restroom. It has to be, the hot water has to be on. I asked for a clarification in statute where it states that. It's been 14 days, and I still don't have an answer to that. Nowhere that I can find in statute does it say we cannot shut the hot water off. But in my home in particular, my hot water heater is 27 years old. If I happen to turn on that dishwasher, it will kick up the temperature of that hot water heater, and the temperature at that bathroom sink will go above 120 degrees. For the safety of the children, I shut the hot water off at the bathroom. The CDC clearly states you don't need hot water to clean your hands. It's more about the safety. Why does it take me 14 days, and I still have not gotten an answer from DHS? DHS is going out and talking to providers. They're still not listening to us.
Okay. Thank you.
And as I've talked to providers, and many have reached out to me, I have not heard any rosy scenarios either. And with that, we are going – anybody else have any questions here? No? Okay, well, then I think that we will adjourn, because I believe taxes is up here.